Campus FM presents A Book, A Thousand Stories. A review of the book, The Hare with Amber Eyes, by Edmond de Waal. Production and presentation, Patricia Salomone. Musical advice by Gerald Fennec, and technical support by Samuel Attard and Carmelo Grech. Listeners, here we are again to continue A Book, A Thousand Stories, our review of this enthralling family saga, The Hare with Amber Eyes, written by Edmond de Waal, descendant of the Efrusi family, Jewish traders, bankers, art collectors of the past. And we proceed, meeting various members of the family and their entourage as Paris enters the fin de siècle period. Their golden house on the Monceau Hill, the three Efrusi brothers have become an accepted part of Parisian society. They are seen in the box, at the premiere at the opera, seen at funerals, at the receptions of Prince X and Countess Y. They are noted for the grand series of dinners that they host together. When the Russian Tsar visits Paris, the Efrusi are there to greet him as prominent Russian citizens. We meet Charles in the fascinating company of his lover, Louise, whose golden blondness, says de Waal, was indeed eroticized languor. De Goncourt compared her to the red-haired mistress of Titian, who, de Waal says, is indeed very golden and very naked, one hand loosely covering herself. The lovers, Charles and Louise, were neighbors, and they met constantly at the round of receptions and balls, and the two families often holidayed together at the Chalet Efrusi in Switzerland, or at the Caen d'Anvers Chateau at Champs-sur-Marne, just outside Paris. Lovers might have needed the back room of antiques and beaux-arts dealers to get away from all the smothering family and from all the children. They shared a real interest in music, art and poetry, and, consequently, an interest in musicians, artists and poets. They were passionate about Wagner and Massenet, assiduously frequenting the Paris Opera. Let us remember that de Waal is a ceramist, an artist for whom the sense of touch is paramount. He writes, "I want to find how these nonchalant Parisians, Charles and his lover, handled Japanese things. What was it like to have something so alien in our hands for the first time? A box, a cup, a netsuke? Japanism is in fashion, a fetish in the mid-19th century Europe. Everyone, writes the Waal, had to get their hands on these japoneseries. All the painters Charles met in the salons, all the writers Charles knew from the Gazette, his family, his friends, his family's friends, his lover, all were living through this convulsion. They kept well informed about the arrival of new cargoes of Far Eastern artifacts. Old ivories, enamels, faience and porcelain, bronzes, lacquer, wooden sculptures, embroidered satins, platings, simply arrived on a merchant's shop and immediately entered the hands of Carlos Duran, Manet, James Tissot, Fantin Latour, Degas, Monet and writers Edmond and Jules de Goncourt, Philippe Duberty, Zola, and travelers, Chernusky, Duret, Emile Guimet. De Waal tells us, the movement was established. The amateurs followed. Edmond de Goncourt wrote, "Touch is the mark by which the amateur recognizes himself. The man who handles an object with indifferent fingers, with clumsy fingers, with fingers that do not envelop lovingly, is a man who is not passionate about art." Charles and Louise were neo-Japanists, young and rich artistic latecomers. By the time these lovers became amateurs of Japanese art, the way to their becoming connoisseurs was open, for, wealthy as they both were, they could have it in quantity and they could have it now. How exciting it must have been to be collectors! This was an epiphany of new materials, bronzes of a depth of patina that seemed far greater than that of the Renaissance, lacquers of an unparalleled depth and darkness, folding screens of gold leaf to bisect a room and throw light. The artistic and intellectual were absolutely charmed. Manet painted La Japonaise, his wife Camille in a thickly embroidered robe, while James Tissot, La Japonaise au Bain, a girl is naked, but for a heavy brocade kimono, loose on her shoulders, standing on the threshold of a Japanese room.
Japanism, or Japonisme in French, was a term first utilized in 1870s Paris. Japan had just emerged from a period of national seclusion and had reopened its trade with the West. Many exotic items flooded the Parisian market and the locals succumbed to a love affair with Japan. The craze for Japan was indeed so great that Edmond de Waal in his book mentions that Siegfried Bing, owner of the Oriental Art Boutique, brought back 45 crates of Japanese objects from one buying trip alone. Japanese art was everywhere in Charles Effrissi's Paris, not just in the woodblock prints which proposed a new look at reality, but also in the silks, ivories, brocades, lacquers and bronzes available for purchase. It was a case of art pouring out into daily life and creating an air of undeniable eroticized possibility. The introduction of woodblock prints, especially the landscapes of Japanese artists Hiroshige and Hokusai, had an immediate effect on the Impressionists. The unusual compositional techniques and the lyrical coloration, which captured momentary atmospheric light, appealed to the Impressionists, who, at the time, were progressively distancing themselves from traditional French academic painting. Woodblock prints provided them with an opportunity to paint scenes that did not follow the academic tradition of central perspective. The Impressionists felt that a new pictorial language was needed to reflect the dramatic changes that industrialization and mechanical technologies had brought to society. A new sensitivity to the transience of the moment, as well as the increasing cosmopolitan nature of a prospering middle class, called out for a new artistic language to capture modern life, with its theaters, cafes, cabarets, and boating parties on the Seine. American-born James McNeill Whistler lived in Paris in the early 1860s. In 1864, Whistler painted his girlfriend in a purple and gold kimono, looking at Hiroshige's woodcuts. The bird's eye perspective leaves little doubt as to where his artistic inspiration came from. In 1866, Edouard Manet painted his friend, the writer Émile Zola, at his desk. The painting shows a Japanese woodcut on the wall to the right, whilst to the left the artist has included a prominent Japanese screen. Edgar Degas also possessed many of these colored Japanese woodcuts and felt an attraction for the world of transient pleasure, such as opera and ballet. With Degas, it is the way the artist crops pictorial space and his asymmetrical compositions that capture the mood of this craze for Japonisme. Claude Monet covered the walls of his house at Giverny with Japanese woodcuts, and they served as inspiration for his beautiful garden with its famous water lilies. In one of his paintings, entitled Japanese Bridge, he removed the traditional notion of the vanishing point and produced a painting that does not give any hint at all of spatial depth. Vincent van Gogh famously commented, "You see more with Japanese eyes, you feel the colors differently." Van Gogh also copied Hiroshige's famous plum tree, but gave his version a deliberate and intense coloration and therefore a more emotional aura. Japonisme therefore had a significant effect on Charles's group of artist friends. The calligraphic quality of these new prints, with their simplified subject matter, abstraction of color, and sense of repetition, was a game changer for the Impressionists. It gave them an opportunity to create a new artistic language full of atmospheric content and a new perception of how light, mood, and movement could be expressed.
And finally, we have a description of the mysterious Netsuke. They were objects that were unlike anything in Western art. Objects that could only be described as playthings, small carvings of animals and beggars called netsuke, that you could roll in your hands. Very rich, very simple, very tactile. Japanese and touch were a seductive combination for Charles and Louise, among many others. Now, in Charles's life, sex and Japonisme are intertwined. Charles's passion for the Golden Louise transpires in his writings in the Gazette. It intermingles with his growing love of the paintings of the Impressionists, the images of flowering apple trees, cloud-filled skies and women in flowing robes that are straight out of Pissarro and Monet, and Japanese things, lacquers, prints, netsuke. All conjure a picture of a place where sensations are always new, where art pours out of daily life, where everything exists in a dream of an endless, beautiful flow. Lefroussi so enjoys the spirit of art that he internalizes how art unfolds through history. So his choices catch the spirit of the moment. They also evolve and change with the passing of time and the changing of fashion. And so Charles buys his netsuke, 264 of them. Did he pick these charming Lilliputian trinkets in one lot from Philippe Sichel's showroom, packed as it was with objects which the trader had unearthed in some Nagasaki bazaar? Or did Charles collect his netsuke bit by bit over the years? De Waal is not quite sure about this. What is certain is that just as the Japanese are small, they make small things. They represent emotion and everyday life. Sichel, Charles Lefroussi, de Goncourt, and many other collectors share the same thoughts as those of Rudyard Kipling, who in 1889, on visiting a Japanese market, was awestruck and wrote that he perceived. Cabinets of old gold and ivory studded with jade, lazuli, agate, mother of pearl and cornelian. But to me, more desirable than any wonder of five-stoned design are the buttons and the netsuke that lie on cotton wool and can be taken out and played with. Japanese things were props for dressing up, role-playing, the sensuous reimagining of oneself. So they naturally appealed to Charles. Japan was a treasure trove of art objects to be had at bargain price. There were passers-by who would sell the netsuke from their obi, their belts. Back in Paris, these little objects cost a fortune, but Charles has the connoisseur's eye and the collector's urge, and he has money. In fact, his fortune went on growing by the year with that of his family. De Waal asks, did he fall in love with the startlingly pale hair with amber eyes and buy the rest for company? The list of his collection is quite endless. A fox with inlaid eyes in wood, a curled snake on a lotus leaf in ivory, a standing warrior, a monkey and its young, a couple making love, a naked woman and an octopus, for the Japanese could do erotica, particularly using octopuses, which were especially hunted out for their sinuosity. Charles buys a black wood vitrine, polished like lacquer, just over 6 foot high, and puts his collection inside. They were all placed on green velvet, and the mirror at the back let the netsuke slide away into infinities of collecting. Just imagine the wonder of this, and allow me here a brief personal interlude. I remember as a child that my parents had a drinks cabinet which was lined in beveled mirrors. I loved peeping right through. As I did, the cabinet lit up, and I actually placed my head inside, seeing the little colored liqueur glasses multiplied over and over again, as through a kaleidoscope. vitrine, writes De Waal, as opposed to a museum's case, is for opening, looking, choosing, and reaching in and picking up, is a moment of seduction, an encounter between hand and an object, which is electric. But back to Charles. We are now by the vitrine in Charles's study, under the Renaissance tapestries, by the yellow armchair, as Charles works at writing his book on Dürer. We will be with Charles next week as he labors over his book, Dürer, Essai de Saint. He writes passionately, expounding on the value of this German master, for whom he has endless admiration. We will also hear how he becomes an older brother to the new brotherhood of artists as he begins his collection of Berthe Morisot, Manet, Renoir and Pissarro works, always encouraging, sponsoring, advocating the new style of these emerging artists. We shall see how Charles enters art history as the dark, elegant, rather incongruous figure wearing a top hat at a casual boating party in Renoir's Le Déjeuner des Canotières. We will also see how, being a friend to the artists, he understands their needs and intervenes on their behalf. Renoir was in need of money, so Charles persuades an aunt to sit for him. Then he persuades Louise to commission two paintings, one of Louise's eldest daughter, Irene, with reddish, golden hair like her mother. The second painting is of Louise's two younger daughters, Alice and Elizabeth. It is a saccharine portrait of the younger girls, who also have their mother's hair. They stand in front of a dark burgundy curtain, held open to reveal the salon beyond, holding hands as if for reassurance, a confection of pink and blue ruffles and ribbons. These little girls too will enter history, but this is a story I shall tell later, much later, in my series, A Book, A Thousand Stories. Till then, mes amis, au revoir. Thank you. I'm grateful to Caroline Lajani for her expert contribution to this episode of A Book, A Thousand Stories.